This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, it's Friday, and you know what that means. It's another episode of Good Things, the show where we talk to good people who are doing good things. I'm Dashrin Johan, and my guest on today's show is Adrian Pereira, who has been working with migrant communities and fighting for their rights for more than two decades. In 2011, he co-founded the North-South Initiative, which is a CSO to help bridge solidarity and equality gaps in terms of human rights and social justice. Welcome to the show, Adrian.
Hi, thank you. Happy to be here.
So you've been working with migrant and refugee communities, fighting for their rights for more than two decades now. What inspired you to embark on this journey?
So my mom, when I was very young, my mom would take me to visit the plantations. I come from a small town called Kota Tinggi, and she would pack a lot of groceries in a van and travel for 2 to 3 hours to visit some of the families who were having difficulties with life. And I think I was about seven or eight years old that time. And it gave me an insight to inequalities, the discrimination, and the poverty that people faced. And those images I still carry in my mind till today. And what I find more inspiring that my mom does is still today she journeys with many of those families who she was helping, and some of them have overcome poverty and some of them have not. And this is basically the framework that helped me build my worldview on not just human rights and social justice work, but also the migration scene.
Before setting up the North-South Initiative, which we will get to in just a sec, you worked with two UN-accredited international organizations, which is the Pax Romana International Movement of Catholic Students, as well as the Dignity International. What can you tell me about these organizations and what did you learn from your time working there?
When I graduated from university, I was inspired by different movements, different leaders from different organizations who showed me that you can make a difference in the world. And I think it's important I mentioned that one of the first NGOs I worked with was Pusat Komas. It really helped frame my interaction with the grassroots communities. And after about 2 years working there, I had a chance to go to work in Manila for about 3 years, where the Asian Secretariat of Pax Romana was located. And after 3 years of working there, I came back to Malaysia, and I just happened to have a friend who was running Dignity International, and I thought, okay, let me contribute in whatever way I can. So these two organizations played a very important role, as it inspired me to work very intimately with grassroots organizations and community members, but elevating their advocacy and solidarity to a global level. So I saw my role very clearly at that point on how we can create and provide spaces for grassroots to share their stories at a global level. And it was very powerful because we had chances to speak at regional forums. We had the grassroots members talking at the UN, and it had a big impact on the grassroots realities. And of course, knowing that Malaysian government doesn't really have a good working relationship with rights-based organizations, these international platforms played a very important role. And till today, I still continue my advocacy and solidarity with Pax Romana. And I think at the end of the day, when it comes to human rights issues, the grassroots voices need to be at the center.
So when did you decide to start the North-South Initiative? I mean, what was the light bulb moment?
I mean, we didn't really have like a major strategic plan to set it up. I was working with the Patani community for many years, from 2007. Patani is something that is very close to my heart. I first came to know about the violence and the armed conflict since the Takbai incident in 2004. So and every year I make sure I pay a visit across the border to be with the community to understand their situation. And one day I just had a chance to do a training. There was a small grant by the British Embassy here. And, you know, to get access to a grant, you need to have a legal entity. So I called up my friends in Patani and said, okay, what do you think about this? You know, there's a chance to do a media advocacy training. And three of us, my two other co-founders, Anne Batteries and Shaharuddin, or who we called in Patai, we came together and we registered NSI. So it was something very organic. It started to grow as a youth empowerment organization. Mm. And along the way, the migrant and refugee community felt comfortable with working with us. They started sharing certain cases and we also took up these cases. We didn't feel fair to dump all the burden on the other organizations who are already struggling with the human rights issues. So we took up these issues and here we are today. Yeah.
Mm. Now, NSI was, as you mentioned, set up with the help of a grant in 2011. And then in 2015, y'all started operating as a fully fledged CSO. What happened in between?
Yeah, so to set up an organization, especially a human rights organization, it's really not easy. And coming from an activist background, it took time to learn the management skills, the accountability skills, the compliance, and of course, ensuring that, you know, we practice integrity at every stage of the work. So that took me a bit of time to learn, and I was really blessed with different seniors who were coaching me along the way. So that took a bit of time. And 2015, we really opened the doors as a full-fledged organization and started getting more people on board, doing a more effective fundraising. And of course, as we grow, the responsibilities and the burdens also increase. So the topic itself, you know, migration, conflict resolution, are topics that have been there in Malaysia for some time, but because the CSO scene is not as vibrant and, you know, as our neighbors, for example, Indonesia, Thailand, Philippines, so it takes a bit more time to like kickstart an initiative, even if it's small. Yeah.
Let's talk about what exactly this North-South initiative actually is. Why the name North-South Initiative? What exactly are y'all trying to bridge here? Because when it comes to Malaysian context, right, we often hear about the East and the West, for example, you know, East Malaysia, West Malaysia. So what exactly is the North-South Initiative and what are your goals and how do y'all go about achieving them?
Yeah, so actually, there's two parts of the story when it comes to how we came up with our name.
Mm-hmm.
When we had that grant, and I called my friends in Patani, so they said, "Oh, Adrian, okay, we are located in the north, and you guys are in the south, so let's call it North-South Initiative." But right. Then we had the deeper discussions of how the global development scene has been labeled. The developing countries have been labeled South for many years, and of course the North, the developed countries. So that gap we feel, of course, today the definitions and the nuances are not so clear because development has been defined in more deeper ways to include human development and not just the GDP growth or right. poverty as per US dollar, per person or per month. So that is the gap that we were planned to bridge. And basically, because we are so grassroots orientated, we plan to ensure that grassroots issues are put on the table, not by us, but by the communities themselves. So that process takes a few years. It takes a kind of like a cycle from awareness to empowerment to emancipation. And this cycle continues. Even though we are about, 10 years old, I think my personal theory is a good empowerment cycle would take about 10 to 15 years for the community. So this has been my experience with the different grassroots communities I work with. And I think some of my proudest achievements is when I see the grassroots sitting at the policy tables, sitting in Putrajaya and sharing directly without intermediaries. What are their issues? What do they want? What do they need? So that's the mission and vision of NSI in a nutshell. Yeah.
And how do y'all go about achieving this? What exactly do y'all do?
Yeah, so we do a lot of trainings for the grassroots communities. We're just blessed that we have a network of senior activists from all over the world who have journeyed with us and come on board when we need to do this training and empowerment. And how we do this is we coach the grassroots leaders. So it's from the migrant community, from the refugee community, and even from the young people in Malaysia and, for example, the Patani community, on how to use the human rights tools. And we coach them, we train them, we test out these tools at a very local level. And as they grow, their communities also grow. They expand their membership, for examples. And of course, the ultimate goal is for them to, to sit in different decision-making platforms. It could be, for example, the ASEAN Forum on Migrant Labour. And, when Malaysia was the host, I was very proud that, an actual migrant community leader was there on the panel and presenting. It's something very... very rare that happens. And of course, when it comes to the labor reform policies, we have migrant community leaders also sitting in different networks. For example, the Labor Law Reform Coalition, where the trade unions, the NGOs, and the migrant community sits together and proposes the labor reforms to the government of Malaysia.
Right.
So it's a very dynamic thing. Besides training, there's also community organizing component, which is the heart of grassroots activism. Unfortunately, in Malaysia, community organizing is not as popular as it should be if you compare with our neighbors.
What do you mean by that?
So, after the certain clampdowns on movements, from Ops Lalang and even the Reformasi clampdown, a lot of grassroots movements were not kind of targeted and seen as a threat to society. And this broke the culture of community organizing because it was seen as something that would threaten the status quo. So many activists kind of moved away from that model of community organizing. And I think that's why, in general, human rights isn't as vibrant as it should be in Malaysia. But I hope this doesn't remain static. It's never too late to keep organizing communities.
On the show with me today is Adrian Pereira. He's the co-founder of the North-South Initiative. We'll be back with more on Good Things, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Good Things, the show where we talk to good people who are doing good things. My guest on the show with me today is Adrian Pereira. He's the co-founder of the North-South Initiative, CSO, to help build solidarity and bridge equality gaps in terms of human rights and social justice. So, Adrian, when we talk about, you know, migrants, refugees, we have to talk about the COVID-19 pandemic. What was the situation of migrant workers when it comes to, let's say, access to healthcare prior to the pandemic? And how did the pandemic exacerbate everything?
It's a very sensitive topic because I think there was a misunderstanding by the public healthcare community. When we critique the system, we are not criticizing the frontliners. The critic is actually on the policymakers who didn't get the formula right to ensure that, you know, everyone is protected during the pandemic. So, for example, of course, we appreciate the government's position to vaccinate everyone, all migrants, the refugee community, irregardless of their documentation or their identity. But the way it was implemented was very messy. It was there were conflicts of interest involved. That of course has led to a very difficult situation for the migrants and refugees to come and get vaccinated. And of course at this stage a lot of damage control is being done. I can see some effort taken in the last 1 month to fix this problem, but it's a bit late. It just shows that, you know, by that we have misplaced our sense of nationalism, and end of the day, we have victimized both Malaysians and migrants by not ensuring vaccination for the most vulnerable in society. Yeah, I think that's my analysis of things. I think there's a lot of space for improvement. Even basic things like, and this is not just in the pandemic, even in the industries, basic cultural communication competencies are missing. And I'll give you an example. You know, in companies, there are notice boards in instructions to the migrants. Even healthcare information, very, very little has been translated into languages that are understood by migrants. And do take note, Malaysia is a country that has been dependent on labor migration for almost 30 years. And if we still don't know that our migrant friends need translations, I think something is really, really wrong with our cultural intelligence, you know. And come on, you know, Malaysia, we look at many of our ancestors, are immigrants themselves. I don't mean to make this distinguish this point, but you know, coming from an immigrant background, all the more we should understand cultural intelligence, but we don't. So I think these are some of the gaps that need to be fixed very urgently. I think there's a lot of improvement when it comes to the healthcare of the migrant worker. The introduction of SOCSO is a good start. It's not the full package which a Malaysian would get, but it's a good start. From there, we need to focus on, you know, equality and non-discrimination. Yeah, because end of the day, the government, the economy is still going to rely on the labor of migrants. Yeah, and of course, that's another topic by itself.
What laws do you think need to be tabled and amended in Parliament immediately, especially when we look through the prism of building a better system based on the goals of NSI is, you know, to build a better system based on principles of social justice?
So we need to stop looking at migration from the lens of security threats. I mean, I can understand why governments do that. Border protection is a valid concern, you know, and even now the threat of terrorism is looming over at a global scale, you know. But the sincerity and the authenticity of the government is yet to be seen in how it manages migrant workers, for example. And even the right to work for refugees has been delayed for so long. And without a comprehensive policy for managing migrant labor, obviously the migrant workers, the refugees, are going to continue becoming victims of forced labor and human trafficking. And there's enough reports, enough research done to show how bad, how terrible our track record is. I just still today can't see the government's political will to reform this. Even when the previous minister, YB Kula, had his committee, his special committee, independent committee to investigate the labor migration situation, till today the report has not been made public. So what is the government trying to hide? Now, structural changes have to be made, and one of the biggest proposal has been to ensure that labor migration is solely managed by the Ministry of Human Resource. And this will prevent conflict of interest with the Home Affairs Ministry. It's just so messy. There's been reports by the Public Accounts Committee, by Parliament, about the irregularities. About the different, you know, conflict of interest that are happening within the ministry. So this needs to be fixed. And if this is not fixed, we'll just continue to be portrayed through different research and reports as a hub for human trafficking. NSI sincerely believes that we, together with different coalition, different movements, that this can be solved. But if there are actors who are depending on the political financing through forced labor, through human trafficking, then I think we have a very big problem. Yeah.
See, Adrian, these are great ideas. And a lot of people, whether it's on BFM or, other media platforms, a lot of people have great ideas. A lot of advocates, activists have fantastic ideas. And sometimes the problem seems so obvious, or the solution seems so obvious. What exactly is preventing all of these ideas from actually taking shape? What's going on? Because, whether we look at, this government, even the previous government, when it comes to crafting policies, groundbreaking policies, that are going to change things in a big way, It's not been exciting. It's been, very, regardless of which the government, even if it's moving in a certain right direction, it's very slow. Even when we talk about a lot of reforms, it's about elite political reforms. Not so much, really seismic shifting policies that will, really see people at the grassroots really feel a huge impact. So what's preventing these ideas from taking shape, Adrian?
Yeah, so my analysis points that we have a chronic problem with our democratic processes. Even the fact that we don't have local council elections is a red flag that our decision making processes are really flawed and doesn't follow the international norms or human rights standards, So even if you have that brilliant award-winning idea, you just don't have the mechanisms to make it happen. And, for me, while the politicians, in their incompetency and their lack of vision to solve some of these problems. I hope and I pray that the public servants step in and fill that gap. In the labor migration, the trend is the government still feels very afraid to talk with the migrant rights NGOs. It's mind-boggling. Till today, I don't know why. They would rather prefer to talk to the UN bodies, to the different UN agencies, and I'm suspecting it's because, you know, these guys have grants. I mean, okay, the grants come and go. You do a project, you finish, but social justice cannot be dependent on a grant. It cannot be dependent on how the political flavor of the day is. These are long-term transformative processes that need everyone's buy-in. And I see this very big flaw in our decision-making processes in Malaysia. Even from the time, for example, if a bill is proposed, we're just lucky that the labor-related bills are made public by the Ministry of Human Resource. We then have debates, we have town hall meetings. But after that, once it is tabled in Parliament, we have no clue. We have no clue about the quality of the document proposed, whether the parliamentarians are competent enough to understand. And even after working in labor rights for almost 10 years, I still find many aspects of the law very complicated and complex. What more if, you know, you have a parliamentarian who has no background of labor or even migration deciding certain things? So I think that whole process is highly problematic. You then suddenly, we even saw conflicts where they were trying to undo certain laws at the Senate level, you know. So I have my theory is the very fundamentals of democracy doesn't exist yet in Malaysia, and this leads to, you know, the much bigger problems. Like you said, you know, you can have brilliant ideas, but the system just doesn't allow you to implement them. And even if you implement a good idea, you may not have a good enforcement body to see that it's done. And this is the very sad example is, you know, we came up with a good law on housing for workers. But you know, it just, I mean, even after the cooling period and the grace period to implement it, you know, end of the day, we still can't get it done. You know, we still can't do the enforcements. So I think that Malaysia has a long way to go. Let's keep the discussion going. Yeah.
Are things changing though, Adrian? Because, you know, this topic has been, you know, discussed for years. You've been on this journey or in this path in the industry for, like you mentioned, you know, 20 years, 30 years even perhaps. How much has actually changed over the past 10 to 15 years? I mean, we know that the path to progress is long and winding, but is our country even moving in the right direction? We talk about, you know, like how the administrations in the past, there was a strong move by the system to, you know, curb and clamp down on movements. You talk about Ops Lalang, we talk about, you know, the early stages of the Reformasi movement, ISA being used, people disappearing, being chucked into prison, all these kinds of things, killed movements. But are things changing?
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult question. We have seen some change, some behavioral change at the grassroots level, at the middle class level, in terms of awareness that, hey, something is chronically wrong. We need to make the change. But the next steps of how to make that change, what are the different platforms, what are the different tools to use, I think that still needs to be sharpened. In terms of politics, unfortunately, it's still the same brand. It's still the same race-based politics. It's still the same elitist type of politics. I haven't seen that reforms happen yet. So it will have to start at the bottom. As long as the grassroots keep the pressure and not give up, I think along the way, the bigger picture's change will happen. But at the moment, it's still quite quite slow. But you know, that's the global, not just Malaysia. I think the global realities trying to cope with COVID has also put a stop in a lot of the efforts. But that's not give up. Malaysia has shown that the will is there, the will to change is there, and we saw that during the last elections. I couldn't believe it, but then of course, you know, it showed how fragile it is, and that painful and bitter experience is something that all Malaysians should reflect on. You know, we made the change. A few months later, it went back to square one. We should never take things for granted. Political change, democracy is a long-term process. It's not a one day, once a year going to the ballot box and finish. You know, there's a lot of lobbying that needs to be done. You know, I tell all my friends, you know, just pay a visit to your local MP's office. Pay a visit to your ADUN's office. Have a dialogue. I don't see that happening. And when you don't interact with the people you represent, they will misrepresent you in many issues. You know, it's just unfortunate that we don't have local council elections. We don't have the concept of consulting. You don't have the culture of local wisdom where, you know, the politicians go to the ground and do consensus building. They don't do that. I have seen this in Thailand. I've seen this in Philippines. I've seen this in Indonesia. Philippines even has a local elections for the youth group at the village level, you know. So I'm not saying that these countries are perfect. They have their own fair share of problems, but they have done the fundamental homework. They have those practices in places. But in Malaysia, we are still grappling with, you know, race-based politics and unequal distribution of wealth, you know. So that puts puts our democracy in a very high-risk situation. Yeah, I really hope everyone has learned from the Sheraton move. Mm-hmm. How fragile, you know, democracy can be. So let's not take it for granted. I strongly believe that Malaysia can have a very bright future, but the reforms must happen. Yeah.
Now, circling back to the core of a lot of our conversation, this idea about you know, migration and migrants' rights, refugee rights, and all of that. Do you think that this idea of migration has been misunderstood in Malaysia? I know it's a weird question to ask, right? But you always tweet about how it's okay for people to migrate or seek refuge in our country. It shouldn't be a problem. And you also emphasize that it's okay for Malaysians who want to migrate to seek for better opportunities. I wonder if people as a whole need to be more accepting of this idea of migration.
Many of our our ancestors are of immigrant heritage. You know, it shows that, you know, we have a rich understanding of culture, but maybe along the way through the education system, through the national politics, we have forgotten that, you know, where we have come from. I remember in my early school days that, you know, when the teachers would ask us to introduce ourselves, you know, I had friends who would proudly say, okay, my father is from Jawa, or my grandfather is of Bugis descent. We were very proud to share where we came from. But today, probably because of the political environment, people have become a bit artificially conscious of their migrant or immigrant heritage. And we want to like isolate that from our identity. So migration has then seen as a very negative action or a negative response. The reality is we live in a globalized world. And, you know, the EU, for example, look at the EU. It was set up to ensure mobility of people, the mobility of goods, the mobility of finances, you know, the mobility of business. It's a reality that people have come to realize, you know, it's unavoidable. But since the post-colonial days, you know, we have our right of sovereignty, but that shouldn't be the limiting factor to our human rights and humanity. We should always look beyond, open our hearts, open our minds. And, you know, where Malaysians feel a lack, whether it's a lack of financial income, whether it's a lack of dignity, you know, there's nothing wrong. There's nothing degrading to say, okay, let me go and look for a job in, for example, Singapore. And, you know, before the pandemic, there were almost a million Malaysians working in Singapore. Don't forget, there are Malaysians also doing 3D jobs in other parts of the world. Australia, we had Malaysians in East Asia also doing difficult work. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that, you know. But I'm neither promoting nor opposing migration. It's just a right, and we have every right to choose it, you know, as a solution. It only becomes a bit complicated if it's a forced migration, for example, like what our refugee friends experience.
Right.
They don't have a choice. And today, if you look at the way the climate change is happening, many parts of the world that are experiencing the rising waters, they will have no choice but to tell their citizens, hey, I'm sorry, you need to move from this place to another place. Kiribati is an example. You know, the government is telling them, I'm sorry, you just have to move. And imagine you're moving and climate change, even though the biggest polluters are from the developed countries, the victims are people, are the grassroots people who live next to a shore, who live in an environment that, you know, it's that could cause massive flooding anytime. So we need to deal. Malaysians need to accept that, you know, with this very changing global climate, there's nothing wrong to migrate and to be kind to those who have decided to migrate here. And of course, labor migrants, you know, according to the law and policy, they're only here for temporary work. But while they're here, let's treat them with dignity, including our refugee and asylum seeking friends.
All right. As we wrap this conversation up, Adrian, would you have a final message for us?
So, what I would advise to the Malaysian public is be aware of your surrounding, be mindful of the different communities around you that need help. It could be a fellow Malaysian, it could be a migrant, it could be a refugee. Always be kind to them, be sensitive to their needs. And if you're able to reach out to them, you know, be their friend. Don't judge them for, you know, we'll never know what history or background they have had. And, you know, try take up their case. For example, if it's a labor case, guide them to report it. You know, if it's a security issue, guide them to make a report to the relevant authorities. Unfortunately, you know, the human rights conversations and skills have not been disseminated to the Malaysian public, but learn, pick up human rights knowledge, pick up human rights skills. The NGOs like North-South Initiative, we are always here to help. We're always here to guide you. And we need your hands, we need your ears, we need your eyes on the ground to observe and solve some of these problems. And of course, my message to all entrepreneurs and owners of businesses, treat your workers with dignity. Before pandemic, workers put in a lot of effort to help you gain profits. Now, during difficult times, please channel those profits back to workers who are facing difficulties so that they can help their families live with dignity. Yeah, that would be my humble and sincere message to all Malaysians.
On that note, thank you so much for joining me today, Adrian.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
That was Adrian Pereira, co-founder of the North-South Initiative. If you missed any part of our conversation, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, BFM.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Dashran Johan, and this has been Good Things, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.